You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Today we welcome Jeff Sechel back to the show. He is an historian and a former speechwriter for President Clinton. His books include Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade, and Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. He has a great new book. It's called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. Jeff Sechel, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I you were such a hit on the show last time that I invited you back immediately 11 years later.
Well, I've got to write more books.
Yes. What have you been doing since the last time we spoke?
Oh, I was going to say I have a lot of books on my bookshelf, but I haven't written very many of them. Yeah. Well, I've been very lucky to be busy in the interim. I'm not just working on this book, but I have a very busy day job at a place called West Wing Writers, which is a group that we started at the end of the Clinton administration, a few of us who were speechwriters for him. And we write for folks in a lot of different realms and do communication strategy and a lot of other things.
I haven't read President Clinton's novel, but I was reading his autobiography. I'm not quite done with it yet. I started it when it came out, and I'm working my way through.
It's a big book.
Brevity, that's the thing. But it's very detailed.
It is that. Well, you see, when we were speechwriters for him, we had a cliche oft repeated that we give him Hemingway and he turns it into Faulkner. So this book, that autobiography, that is Faulkner.
Right. Yes, there. Absolutely. But he talks about Elvis. I like his take on Elvis Presley. I want to ask you before we start talking about the Mercury program, in light of the situation with the Supreme Court now, and people are talking and have been talking since before Biden was elected about how President Biden might try to change the makeup of the court. And having studied Roosevelt's failed attempt to stack the court, do you have any insights into what could happen or might happen?
I never really believed that President or then candidate Biden was all that interested in packing the Supreme Court. He was certainly getting a lot of pressure to be in favor of it from many Democrats and progressives who are frustrated, as no doubt Joe Biden is frustrated with the direction this court is going, and also with what Mitch McConnell did during the last 4 years to build on the conservative majority that the court already had through unprecedented means, such as keeping the late Justice Scalia's seat open for the better part of a year so that President Obama would not have a chance to fulfill his constitutional prerogative and appoint someone to the seat. So there's an enormous amount of frustration on the left, and that is only going to increase, and particularly in light of the decision that we just saw at the end of this last term on voting rights. There's more to come. That is not a narrow majority, 6-3. And they are really just getting started. And so I think you're going to continue to see a lot of energy on the left in favor of packing the court or in favor of court reform in one way or another. But I don't know that I think we have a very, very long way to go before that becomes even remotely politically possible. I mean, you'd have to have a Democratic majority larger than it would have to be filibuster proof, number one. And we're not anywhere near that. So I don't really think the conversation can begin seriously until you have that many votes.
And when President Roosevelt tried it, he had a lot of power, didn't he? Yeah.
He had enormous amount of power. In fact, at the time, he was seen to be the most powerful president in history. He had massive Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress. The country, after Roosevelt's re-election in 1936, the country was closer to one-party rule than it had been since Reconstruction. So he had an enormous amount of power. And he was shocked, to put it mildly, at the pushback he got from his own party when he proposed to pack the court.
I guess the difference between then and now is, and I think this is, it's difficult to say how people feel regardless of their political affiliations because people are so tightly in their bubbles. But I mean, there is a certain inequity and unfairness in what happened in the fact that McConnell refused to hear Merrick Garland and then rushed through another judge in like 20 minutes.
Yeah, unfairness is one way of putting it. I could probably come up with a few other words as well. I mean, it was wrong in every way. The fact that it was legal and constitutional doesn't make it right, and doesn't make it consistent with McConnell's own position or anyone's position up to that point. So there is a sense on the part of a lot of people that there is an illegitimacy to at least two out of those three Trump appointments. And that gives steam and gives energy, moral energy, to this this push to pack the court, that something has to be done to right the situation, because these seats were, in a sense, unfairly stolen.
The bubble that that I just mentioned, the divide that we're living in now, which is so, I think it's more intense than it's ever been, but I guess it was starting during the Clinton administration. I remember that President Clinton, I remember hearing some news reporter say that President Clinton's honeymoon period was basically the transition, because most presidents have a honeymoon. But I mean, if it's during the transition, then that's not a very useful honeymoon, because you can't accomplish anything until you're actually inaugurated. And since you knew President Clinton, what were his frustrations about the formation of this divide?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in suggesting that this was not some golden era of bipartisanship. We certainly didn't feel that way at the time. It was a poisonous environment in Washington. And the things that the Clintons were not only accused of, but investigated for by Republicans in Congress, included murder, for example. I mean, it was, I remember seeing the great columnist and before that great speechwriter, Peggy Noonan, giving a book talk here in Washington. She had just written an anti-Hillary book, and she said with great gravity and sadness, she said that she had been forced to conclude the simple fact that the Clintons don't love their country. So this was the environment in the 1990s. And we were able to get a lot of things done despite that. And it is true that as bad as it was then, it's worse today. And so there was still some possibility in that environment of getting some things done on a bipartisan basis, which was really the only way you were going to get anything done. And Clinton developed a political strategy, as it was called, of triangulation, of sort of pushing back against the margins of both parties to try to find a kind of middle position. And he came in for a lot of criticism for it from progressives in the Democratic Party, but it was effective, and a lot got achieved during that period of time. So Clinton found a mode in which he could accomplish some things. It is without question harder today.
Do you see any hope for the future in terms of this divide?
I'm not sure that I am over-brimming with hope about the divide in the country somehow narrowing in some meaningful way. But I do think that we are getting better at calling it what it is and recognizing it. And I think that whether it's changes that we're beginning just maybe to see in tech that will remove some of the forms in which hate has really flourished, or whether it's seeing a little more forcefulness on the part of members of the Democratic Party in acknowledging what's going on and not being afraid to say so. I'm hopeful about that. And I'm hopeful that there are actually at least a few people in the middle who actually do share a common desire of making progress, whether it's on something that ought to be uncontroversial, like infrastructure, or on some of the more controversial questions.
You've just written a new book, and it's called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War, Jeff Schessel. You wrote this in an era that you've covered slightly before, when you wrote your first book about Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Were you able to mine some of the research that you had done there?
It was less about mining the research than just returning to my understanding of and my enthusiasm for a lot of the characters of that period. Lyndon Johnson, as you mentioned, is an important character in the first book. It's about him, but he's also an important character in this book as well, as someone who understands before John Kennedy does that space is going to be a battleground, and that there is a need in both and a political opportunity in asserting leadership in that area. So it was wonderful for me to get to revisit Lyndon Johnson in this slightly different context. Robert Kennedy also appears in this volume, but he wasn't so central to the discussion of space.
I think one of the things that history has told us was that Lyndon Johnson was a colossal liar, as among all the other things that he was colossal in. But I was really kind of interested to see that there was a little bit of lying on the part of President Kennedy, particularly like the missile gap thing, that he repeated this lie over and over again.
Well, the missile gap was a misconception before it was a lie, but it did ultimately become a lie. It's true. Kennedy, there had been a lot of talk on the part, not just of Kennedy, but before Kennedy, on the part of various generals and experts in defense, beginning in the mid-late 1950s, that there was a missile gap with the Soviet Union, and that they had more armaments than they were letting on, more nuclear armaments and so forth. And it had been accepted essentially as fact by the end of the 1950s. And Kennedy saw the incredible power of this as a campaign issue. And he talked a lot about the missile gap on the campaign trail in 1960. Eisenhower, being president, was privy to a lot of intelligence that Kennedy wasn't. And he knew that there was a missile gap, but that it ran in our favor. And actually, the Soviet military was not as powerful, at least in this perspective, from this perspective, as advertised. And Kennedy made so much political hay of this that at a certain point, Eisenhower tried to put a stop to it. And he gave Kennedy a classified briefing to demonstrate to him that the missile gap, as he was describing it, didn't exist. And Kennedy went on to continue talking about it. But he would soon, when he became president, recognize where America was strong and where America was less so. And so he knew the score soon enough.
So Eisenhower, you discovered, was a more straightforward kind of politician than maybe we thought of him as?
Well, Eisenhower was a pretty straightforward guy. He was a pretty practically minded guy. And he was not a fabulist like Lyndon Johnson could be. But Eisenhower had certain blinkers on. He had certain insights that nobody else had. I mean, he didn't just put a term to the idea of the military-industrial complex. This was drawn from his unique understanding, having been the supreme Allied commander in World War II. And he looked at the Pentagon with very clear eyes, and he understood the tendency on the part of Pentagon planners and generals and admirals to justify all manner of expenses in the name of national security as they continued to sort of build their forces and build their strength and their armaments. And he was skeptical about it. But when I say blinkers, I'm really referring to space, among other things. That one thing that Eisenhower just could not see was any value at all in space exploration. And for all the national discussion of it and all the kind of popular interest in it, he thought it was sort of silly, to be honest. He thought it was kind of kids stuff. It was science fiction. He really only had one interest in space, and that was spy satellites. The thing that he was most worried about, and it was the thing that most people were most worried about, was a surprise nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. And U-2 flights were effective, but they were dangerous. They were precarious. And indeed, in 1961, was famously shot down over Soviet territory. Eisenhower thought spy satellites could actually keep an eye on the Soviet Union without incurring that kind of risk. So he was in favor of that. But as far as the other stuff that scientists and engineers were talking about, whether it was meteorological satellites and communication satellites and things like that, he thought they were constantly inventing what he referred to as gadgets to just claim some taxpayer money and do their science experiments on the taxpayer's dime. And when it came to what was known then as man in space, human exploration of space. He had no time for that at all. He had not heard a single argument in favor of manned exploration of space that was at all persuasive to him. And the truth was, there weren't very many powerful and clear and cogent and compelling arguments for man in space, other than that it seemed like the next thing to do. He didn't buy the military arguments that we needed space planes flying around somewhere up there engaging in battle. He wasn't in favor of that. And as far as the scientific stuff, again, as I indicated, he wasn't that interested in having a satellite do it. And he didn't really see any purpose in putting a human being in a can up there to look around. And he understood how much it was going to cost. So he was not interested in it, and it really set the American effort back considerably. He was president, after all.
And he was president when Sputnik was launched, the first satellite, the Russian satellite. And I think everybody at the time, I was alive, but don't have much memory of it, thought that meant that the Soviets could drop a bomb on us from space. And that was a big fear factor.
It was a very big fear factor, and the Soviets did their part to encourage those sorts of fears. They said that their interests in space were peaceful, but nobody believed that that was true for a second. And of course, while they were saying it, they were kind of winking at the global public and talking about all the things that they could imagine that someone could do in space if they didn't have peaceful purposes, like arming these capsules. And so the sense in the United States, and again, this is not just on the part of the public, but on the part of experts, some pretty serious-minded people, was that the Soviet effort was intended not just at getting to space first, but at building a space platform, as they were calling it, a space station, essentially, that would just float in orbit above the United States perpetually, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, or that they were going to build a nuclear base on the moon. There were a few experts who said that it would probably be easier to aim a nuclear missile from Siberia if you're trying to hit the United States than if you're trying to aim one from the moon. But nonetheless, this was taken very seriously, that the Soviets' goal inevitably had to be a nuclear base on the moon, which would put it outside the range of U.S. defenses. So there was a sense of terror that began to build immediately after Sputnik went up about what the Soviets would be able to do.
Well, you can't see Siberia, and you can see the moon.
That's true. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. It is right up there.
Yeah.
Siberia, who knows where it is?
Only Sarah Palin can see it from her.
You have to have the right window.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest this week is historian Jeff Sechel. He was a former speechwriter for President Clinton, and his new book is called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. He's also the author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade, and Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court.
When I was a kid, I grew up watching the space program on get up early in the morning, because I was on the West Coast, and listening to Walter Cronkite count it down, and then wow, you know, watching it go up, and you know, basically all through my entire childhood, that was a feature of my life, and following what the astronauts were doing. And it was an exciting and wonderful time. And I guess President Kennedy understood a piece of that excitement.
He did. He understood it before he shared it, actually. I talked a minute ago about the power that he saw in the missile gap in 1960 as a campaign issue. Well, he also saw the power in the space gap. And he talked about them as being essentially one and the same. I mean, after all, these things that the Soviets were sending into space, at first a little satellite like Sputnik, and then later a dog in a little capsule up there in a satellite, and ultimately they sent a spacecraft to the moon. They did all kinds of things before we did, and they were sending them up on missiles. And so this seemed to speak very loudly and convincingly about Soviet capabilities, technologically and in other respects. And as Kennedy said on the campaign trail in 1960, if the United States is second in space, he said, we're going to be seen as second in the eyes of the world in science and technology and military power, and in this larger struggle that we're engaged in between freedom and totalitarianism. So it was unacceptable to him to be second in space. But he didn't really have a plan to be first. He didn't really know how we were going to achieve that or whether it was even possible at this point. We seemed so far behind the Soviets, whether it was even possible to catch up, never mind to surpass them. And he wasn't, like Eisenhower, he wasn't convinced that it was worth the money. And he struggled with this question, and he struggled and essentially neglected this question until April 1961, when Yuri Gagarin, a cosmonaut, became the first human being to be in space. He orbited the Earth. And that suddenly shocked the system, not only nationally, but at the White House. And Kennedy scrambled to try to put together a plan to leapfrog the Soviets to the moon.
Was President Kennedy aware of more than we were in terms of what the Soviets were doing? I mean, I remember hearing about Yuri Gagarin, but the Soviets kept a lot of their stuff secret, right?
They did. And actually, Kennedy knew very little that the American public or that the global public didn't know about the Soviet space program because they were so successful in keeping a total clampdown in keeping with totalitarianism. They were not inviting the world's press to the launch pad to see whether the thing went up or whether it blew up on the pad like so many of our rockets did. So the Soviets were able to fail in secret. There was a suspicion here in the United States that the Soviets couldn't have a perfect track record and that something was probably going wrong, but we never knew about it. And in fact, there were horrific explosions on the launch pad. One killed over 100 people. Wow. There was a training fire in which one of their top cosmonauts was died in a really horrific fashion. But none of these things were known. That accident wasn't revealed, I think, until the 1990s, or it wasn't confirmed anyway. There were rumors that much later. And so the Soviet program had this air of invincibility. We only ever saw them succeed. They didn't even actually tell the world that they were going to launch Yuri Gagarin into space. They waited until they had done it. And of course, as soon as the rocket took off, our intelligence was tracking these things, and we were aware that it was happening before it was announced. But this was not something, again, that the public really got to see. And by contrast, in our open society, every time one of our rockets exploded on the launch pad or a monkey in a capsule wound up in the ocean rather than coming back safely to Earth, it all happened in front of the cameras and it went in the newsreels.
All of those exploding rockets, yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well,
when you were doing research for Mercury Rising, were you able to research all of the Soviet space program, and did you care to do that?
It wasn't really a focus of mine to really kind of run through all the successes and the failures of the Soviet program. There are some really wonderful books that do that. And now that the archives have been opened, at least in significant part. But I make reference to it. I'm really mostly focused on the experience here in the United States and what our understanding was in the moment, rather than to write a broader history of the space program here and there.
Yeah, your book is in the moment. It's not so much about hindsight, which I really love. Now, it's an exciting book, and I want to talk more about it. But I want to ask you, there were other books about the space program, I guess the most famous being The Right Stuff. And there's this book that's called We Seven. You must have looked at this one.
I did.
Astronauts actually wrote themselves. Somehow I doubt that they wrote it.
They had some help.
and there's Glenn's book, which I really enjoyed reading when it came out. Did you find fault with those books?
It's not so much about finding fault. I mean, finding difference maybe is a way of putting it. I love The Right Stuff. That book is one of the things that drew me into this topic years and years ago. I first read it when I was in college, and of course, seen the movie multiple times, read the book multiple times.
Yeah.
I love that book. And yet I always felt that the rendering of John Glenn was a little thin to me. It seemed like a caricature. John Glenn did incredible things, incredibly dangerous and brave things. And to have him rendered as a kind of a smiling Boy Scout, as a Sunday school teacher, didn't seem to me to really capture that. It felt, again, like, as I said, that something was missing. And I was intrigued by a quote that I read elsewhere. And it was a quote from one of John Glenn's wingmen in Korea when he was combat pilot there. And his wingman was a guy named Ted Williams, who you'll remember, who, of course, was best known as a Red Sox player, one of the greatest hitters of all time. And
last guy to hit
Ted Williams, sorry?
Last guy to hit 400.
That's right. That's right. And he actually had left baseball to fly in Korea and then went back. And Ted Williams said about John Glenn, he said, "The man is crazy. The man is crazy." He loved him. He loved John Glenn. But this is what he said. And I really wanted to know what that meant. Because when you read the right stuff and you see the movie, or even when you read Glenn,
crazy,
where's the crazy? Where's the crazy? And so I wanted to find the crazy. And I'll just give you one story that gives you a sense of it. I mean, Glenn was the fiercest combat pilot of all of the Mercury 7. Not all of them had actually even flown in combat. Alan Shepard, who became the first American in space, had not fought in combat, which was kind of a sore spot with him. But Glenn had not only fought, but he was the most decorated combat veteran of all of them. And he had been absolutely fierce in battle. In Korea, he and his commanding officer were, and this is just one of many stories I could tell you here, but it's really representative. He and his commanding officer were flying toward a target, an anti-aircraft position in North Korea, and they were taking a lot of fire. And his commanding officer said, "Look, let's get out of here." And he circled around and flew away. Glenn disobeyed orders to circle back around and head low and fast toward that target. He was sure he was going to be the guy who could take this target out. What wound up happening is that he got a hole blown in the tail of his jet the size of a basketball. And he somehow managed to get that plane back to base and jumped out and then posed for pictures next to the hole. Wow. And there were a lot of stories, as I said, like this. And Glenn was always the guy who was willing to take the greatest risks. And that kind of crazy is something that you didn't see so much when you were watching the official films or the newsreels about Project Mercury, but it was there. That kind of that intensity, that determination, that ferocity was always in there.
And because he was a natural in front of the camera, his fellow astronauts resented him for that.
They resented him bitterly for a couple reasons. One, because he was a bigger celebrity than they were, but also because he was changing the rules of the game. And they weren't actually interested in trying to do in front of the cameras what he was capable of doing. And they were worried that they were going to have to. Mm-hmm. And that if they wanted to fly first or fly second, that they were going to have to somehow match John Glenn in this other kind of competition. And not just in all the proficiency tests that they were taking. But Glenn, actually, he was the only one of the seven who was a celebrity before he was an astronaut.
Right.
In 1957, so 2 years before the first astronauts got picked, Glenn, as a test pilot at that point, set a speed record flying a Crusader jet from L.A. to Brooklyn in 3 hours and 23 minutes. And he wound up on the front page of every newspaper in the country, hopping out of the cockpit of this jet on the tarmac, being hugged by his attractive family. And he wound up also becoming a guest, and for a period of time, a frequent guest on a CBS game show called Name That Tune. And he was a huge hit. And he would appear in his dress whites one week and his dress blues the next week. And he just charmed the country. So,
and he was teamed, you said, with this little kid who was in the Alfred Hitchcock movie, right? The kid who plays Jimmy Stewart's son in The Man Who Knew Too Much is the same kid, I believe.
Is that the same kid? I didn't even realize that. Yeah. I know that this kid, his name is Eddie Hodges. Yeah, he was 8 years old, I think, when he appeared with Glenn. And he did go on to have something of a career as a child actor and a teen actor. I was watching recently a Dick Van Dyke episode, and he popped up on Dick Van Dyke in 1961 or 62. And they just charmed the heck out of the country. They were really entertaining in a very wholesome middle American way. And so when Glenn walked out on the stage in 1959 as one of the first seven astronauts, the cameras and really the country's attention just all turned right to him. And he was a natural. He knew how to perform in front of a camera. And at that first press conference, and you can see it on YouTube, it is an incredible thing to watch. He is utterly at ease. He's telling stories. He's funny. He's patriotic. He's talking about his faith. He's talking about his family. The other guys are you know, pretty hard-bitten fighter jocks, most of them. And they're not interested in this kind of conversation. They want to talk about flying things very fast. And you can see the body language in this video that exists. You can see the discomfort. And these guys, five of the six, other than Glenn, and the exception is Scott Carpenter, who really became a close friend of Glenn's, but the rest of them were bitter about this for the rest of their lives. And you can measure that by the fact that they wrote memoirs late in life, all of them who lived long enough to do that. And they were still bitter about what John Glenn had done during that press conference. They felt that it was artificial. They felt that he was showing off. They felt that, again, he was changing the rules of the game and that they would lose.
Well, you really, in your book, Mercury Rising, Jeff Shesley, you take us right inside Liberty 7 for that voyage of John Glenn, which I really enjoyed being there. That was some very exciting and great writing. But tell us a little bit, how were you able to reconstruct everything that happened?
There are some wonderful resources. I mean, of course, the communications that Glenn had with the ground, with Cape Canaveral, were all recorded. And so I listened to those recordings multiple times and picked up some things that didn't wind up in the official transcript. And I also, I mean, it's just wonderful what sort of resources are out there, video resources that exist on YouTube, among other places, as well as archival holdings, where you can actually watch 5 hours of press conference, of press coverage of these things, which not everybody would want to do. But when you're writing a book about it, it's a valuable thing to do. Yeah. And this is a broader point, just not with respect to the flight of Friendship 7, but Glenn really kept everything. Glenn was a guy who just stored it all away. And this goes back to when he was a kid. I mean, at the Glenn Archives at Ohio State, which is a phenomenal collection, among other things, Glenn saved the papers that he wrote in high school, some of which are kind of revealing about how he sees his life ahead unfolding. He saved in 1933, when Glenn was 12 years old, somewhere, some travel agency somewhere, he collected some brochures for long-haul flights, relatively long-haul in those days, on Pan Am and other carriers. He was never going to go on these flights. They didn't, the Glens in their little town, New Concord, they didn't have that kind of money, but he collected these things. And not only did he collect them, but he saved them for the rest of his life. And so it's really a gift to anyone who wants to write about his life and write about that period, because the files are filled with notes, notes on flight plans for his space flight, and records in those notes of some really rough disagreements that he had, and ongoing arguments that he had with senior NASA officials, mostly having to do with how much control he and the other astronauts would have over their own spacecraft. The position of NASA was that most of these things should run on autopilot, and that the judgment call should be made at Cape Canaveral and not up in space. Glenn strongly disagreed, to put it mildly. And so there are some wonderful records of all this.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And my guest this week is historian Jeff Shesley. He was a former speechwriter for President Clinton. And his new book is called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. He's also the author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade, and Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court.
When President Kennedy said we would go to the moon by the end of the decade, was NASA surprised? Were they prepared for that? What was that like?
NASA was surprised and not very well prepared. Certainly the administrator, James Webb, had a hand in making that decision, but he was not pushing it. Webb was actually I think you could say he was lightly resisting it because he didn't feel that NASA was ready, and he didn't want President Kennedy to go forward and make a public pledge to something that NASA wasn't going to be able to accomplish. And then he knew that he, Webb, was going to be responsible for making this happen.
Make it happen, yeah.
And he was worried about NASA's capability. And so one of the most famous of the flight directors there at NASA, a guy named Gene Kranz, who's legendary and still with us in his 90s. Yes, he did write a great book. Kranz said, look, we'd had a lot of these rockets blow up in every which way. And the idea that we were going to somehow get a human being to the moon by the end of the decade seemed to us to be kind of crazy. And actually, Kennedy himself thought it was probably a little crazy. I mean, this is one of the things that I think is important to understand about Kennedy. We remember his boldness in making that pledge, especially because it wasn't an empty exercise. As we all know now, we did get to the moon by the end of the decade. It was this great triumph. And so this is like Babe Ruth calling his shot, you know, pointing to the stands and then hitting a home run. But Kennedy actually had been backed into the decision in the way that I described. And when he made that announcement in a speech of May 25th, 1961 to Congress, he soft-pedaled it. He said that he uttered that famous line that we should send a man to the moon and bring him safely back to Earth by the end of the decade. But then if you watch the speech or if you read the transcript of it, he then goes off script and he begins to qualify the goal and to say, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, look, this is going to be really expensive. This is going to be really difficult. And you, the Congress and the American people, you need to think very seriously about whether we're going to commit to this. And if we do, the worst thing that could happen is if we committed to it and we didn't manage to see it through. So think really hard about this. And he's stumbling over his words. He's sort of nervously arranging his papers at the podium and kind of tapping them against the podium. And when he gets back to the White House, he talks to his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, and Sorensen later recalled that Kennedy felt like he hadn't sold it. He said he was reading the crowd and the crowd was not buying it. And in fact, when you look at the commentary that came from members of Congress right after the speech, they're not attacking him and they're not calling it a ludicrous goal, but they're making clear in all sorts of ways short of that, that they're skeptical. And so is the press. The press, rather than declaring that the United States was off on this great historic adventure, was really mostly focused on how much it was going to cost and whether it was technologically even possible. So there was a lot of skepticism in the country, and Kennedy knew that he was going to have to work pretty hard to persuade people otherwise, including himself.
Well, I've often been sad over the last 50 years that we stopped, that we pulled back and we didn't go back. Why did we stop? Was it mainly financial that we didn't continue our explorations? I mean, I know we've continued, but we haven't done that. We didn't go to the moon. We went to the moon, but we didn't build a space station there. We didn't send rockets from there, which was, I guess, the original idea.
I mean, it is interesting that, I mean, if you go back to when this discussion really started in earnest in the 1950s, some of the goals that were seen as near-term goals, like building a space station or flights into Earth orbit and return, are things that we did after going to the moon, which was seen as the impossible dream that was going to take decades to achieve. The moon was seen as the platform to the next frontier and the next one after that. And that's the way they all talked about it, that first the moon, then Mars. And so why did we stop? Why did we sort of curtail our own ambitions? Part of it was, as you said, it was an expenditure that particularly as the 60s gave way to the 70s and the economy began to struggle profoundly. It was just not an expenditure that the U.S. was going to sustain. I think it was also hard to sustain both the spending and the public engagement when it was no longer a race. And we had won. We got to the moon before the Soviets did. In fact, they never got to the moon, human beings. Soviet humans never got to the moon. And then we did it again. And then we did it repeatedly over a period of years. And so the accomplishment itself became a little more commonplace, as incredible as it is to say that. And the imperative was no longer so imperative. And I think the rationale in the early 1960s that this wasn't just a race to see who gets there first, but this was an existential struggle. This was a national security concern of the highest order, that, as JFK said, if the Soviets control space, they can control Earth. That was no longer the sensibility in the country by the late 1960s, or certainly the early 1970s. Yes, there was still a Cold War, but it was not in the kind of acute phase that it was in the early 1960s. And so I think for all of these reasons, it became very difficult to sustain it. And the last thing that I would say on this point is that the rationale was never articulated that clearly. It was a little bit of science. It was a little bit of national security. But from the perspective of the American people, who had a lot of problems right here on Earth, it was never that clear what we were getting out of going to the moon. And once we'd done it, people were ready to move on and to refocus on things closer to home.
Well, we're never going to get our Star Trek future that has been promised us if we don't go to the moon. So.
Well, maybe they should have made that argument.
You follow through in your epilogue with John Glenn through his political career and his return to space. Tell us a little bit about him going back to space, because that's such an exciting thing.
Well, Glenn had always wanted to go back to space and expected to go back to space. This was never meant to be a kind of one and done experience where you get your space flight and then you get a medal and then you go on to do something else. He expected to go back. He wanted to be the first guy to walk on the moon. They all did. He understood that by the end of the decade, he was going to be 50 years old and that maybe it wasn't that likely. But nobody had quite said that yet. So he was going to stick with it and was looking to get back in space, and didn't in the 1960s. And a lot of the resentments of John Glenn, we talked about the resentment of the other astronauts toward Glenn. There was also resentment by many NASA officials toward Glenn, that he was just too outspoken on his own behalf and even on the others' behalf. And they resented his celebrity and the kind of single-minded national focus on Glenn as opposed to anybody else in the program. And so he never got the nod. And they kind of gave him, essentially, it's hard to believe given how celebrated Glenn was, but they kind of gave him the runaround for a couple of years at NASA. And they would never tell him no, but they would start to encourage him to take a desk job, for example. And by 64, really by 63, but especially by 64, Glenn had gotten the message that he was not going back into space. And so he pursued the career in politics that had always been in the back of his mind. And also that President Kennedy, before his assassination, and Robert Kennedy had encouraged Glenn to do. And he wound up, as we know, serving four terms in the U.S. Senate, representing his home state of Ohio. And toward the end of that tour of duty, in the late 90s, he had this idea that NASA should send him back. He was 77 years old, and he thought that this would be a great opportunity to study the effects of aging on spaceflight, that someday we would want to have, that we could understand the aging process better if we understood the effect of space travel on the human body. And they had all this data about Glenn in 1961, 1962, and they could match 98 with 62 and see what they could learn. And he managed to convince Dan Golden, who was the administrator of NASA at the time, and he managed to convince President Clinton. And sure enough, he was able to go back up on the space shuttle in 1998.
Isn't that exciting? What a great coda to his life and career. The book is...
Gary, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but somebody is printing in here from another room.
Oh.
I don't want you to have to pick up the sound. It looks like this is not a long document. It'll be done in a second.
Okay.
I don't know if you're hearing it, but I sure.
I thought maybe it was the blasting off of a...
I think it's done. Okay. All right, we're good. Sorry
about
that. I
didn't interrupt you. Did you have anything more to say there about the...
Space. No.
Okay. The book is so great. I really love it. It's called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. And we talked for a while now, but we've just hardly just a little tiny bit of this book. So I think everybody would really enjoy it. It's a great read. It's just very exciting and wonderful and patriotic book. And thank you for writing it. And thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. I guess I'll see you in another decade.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.